Okay, so at this time we will have the public forum. From what I'm seeing, I do not have speaker cards for items which are not on the agenda.
So Chair Wolf, the agenda says not before 1:30 for the public forum.
I have it myself.
Yeah.
Mine says public forum 12:52, and it is 1 o'clock.
On the agenda.
On the agenda.
Proper.
So I have wrong information here? All right, so slight inconsistency. How's that? So because of the slight inconsistency, I will certainly then move to the farm management considerations.
So good afternoon again, Norm Groot, and this panel, farm management considerations. We have allotted 62 minutes for this, and you'll be hearing about food safety as well as general farm management. So there'll be enough time, I think, between the 22 minutes that we've allowed for questions from the board members to make it through the full 62 minutes. So thank you.
Say that one more time. I was sidetracked a bit.
All right, my voice is really cracking.
No, it
right
was
now.
Me. I was trying to read something and listen at the same time, and it did not work.
Okay. We have 62 minutes allowed for this panel or allotted for this panel. They will be talking about food management considerations as well as general farm management. And we've allowed sufficient enough time for questions from the board members on this because it's important topics. So we should be able to contain this within the 62 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Joe Pizzini with Oceamus Farms.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Sutton with Pisma Oceano Vegetable Exchange.
And I am Scott Horsfall. I'm with the California Leafy Green Products Handler Marketing Agreement.
So today we're going to talk about food safety. We usually try to do food safety before lunch, just to kind of set the tone, but today...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, particularly I had sprouts, so...
Okay, so we're going to talk about farm management considerations and spend some time talking about food safety. I'm going to go to, we'll come back to this slide in a few minutes. There we go. Okay, thank you. So we're here today to present a background about food safety and its requirements on the farm as it applies to fresh produce, especially lettuce and leafy greens. I was asked to be here today not because I'm a food safety expert or have a technical advanced degree, but I, along with other people, had a front row seat to really changing food safety culture a number of years ago. So I happen to be the chairman of the Growers Shipper Association of Central California in 2006 when the foodborne illness outbreak of spinach occurred. Epicenter was in the Salinas area. You know, luck of the draw, I guess, of being a chairman of an organization like that. But nevertheless, I helped with the efforts to lead and create and get the up and running the California Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, which you'll hear a little bit more about in just a few minutes. And so I served as the chairman for the first 3 years of that program. You know, why are we even talking about this today? To illustrate certainly the importance of produce food safety, but also how food safety requirements can be at odds with water quality control orders and the challenges that farmers face in complying with both. but also allows a chance to talk about maybe some unique approaches that we've done with this program and as it may possibly apply to the order as well. But first, a little bit of history, a little bit of background. So this is, you may have heard of Marler Clark, Bill Marler and Bruce Clark, very successful attorneys, food safety attorneys from Seattle. They started their practice, well, actually started representing injured victims of foodborne illness outbreaks back in 1993 with the Jack in the Box incident. And ironically, I believe Marler represented Jack in the Box and Clark represented the victims. And so they, after that was all put together, joined forces. And they probably have as much investigative resources as probably even the government does. And they've built a nice practice with that. But this starts a list of it says lettuce history, but it's not just of lettuce and leafy greens, going back to 1995. So this has been on the radar screen of the regulators for a long time. In fact, in 1998, the FDA issued a guide to minimize microbial food safety hazards for fresh fruits and vegetables. It's kind of a long title, great guidelines, but they were hard to comply with, partly because some of them were very vague. For example, irrigation water must be of appropriate quality to meet its intended purpose. Well, that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And so without a reasonable measure of those metrics, it was a difficult thing to comply with. So coming forward, in 2006, really became a flashpoint for the industry, the lettuce and leafy greens industry, with the spinach foodborne illness outbreak for a number of reasons. First of all, it was 205 illnesses, 5 deaths, and 103 hospitalizations. And it was attributed eventually to bagged spinach from Natural Selections Foods, and it was grown in a ranch over in Piscines. And the pathogen was E. coli 0157H7. And this advisory was different than in the past because the government came out and told everybody, don't eat spinach. So every restaurant, every grocery store had to pull spinach off their shelves, off their menus. It was really handled in a much different way. And what gets forgotten in that year, there was two other significant foodborne illness outbreaks as well. One at Taco Bell, which included 71 illnesses, and another one from Taco John's, another restaurant chain, with 81 illnesses. And that was eventually attributed to chopped lettuce coming from the San Joaquin Valley. So the spinach outbreak launched a massive investigation, multiple local, state, and federal agencies, and it went on for months. In fact, the final report was issued in March of 2007, and here it is. Interesting reading. But it attributed a lot of the concerns were about irrigation water, contaminated irrigation water, animal intrusion, and really poor sanitation practices at the processing plant. But this was a watershed moment for this industry. And it really had, we needed as an industry to really look at our practices and how they were being implemented. And it became apparent to many of us that, we had improvements to make. And one was consumer safety was paramount. We'd forgotten that. I mean, if people don't have confidence in the food you're producing, we'll be out of business. And if one operator had a problem, it affected the entire industry. So maybe it was the farm down the road or the neighbor or some company across the hill, but it affected everybody's business. And as an industry, we needed measurable science-based standards for best management practices in growing and handling lettuce and leafy greens. And we needed a way to ensure growers and handlers were following those practices, those best management practices, because they didn't really exist, not in the way they do today. And so what ultimately came out was a marketing agreement that enforced food safety standards for lettuce and leafy green handlers, and it's enforcing that those products were grown with good agricultural practices. And it was this public-private partnership that we call it, California Leafy Greens Products Handler Marketing Agreement, or the LGMA for short, and that started in 2007. But the tenets of that were science-based standards that could change with advancing science. So as the research came along, those standards could be adjusted to reflect the latest research, and that the standards were enforceable, they were clear, and you could audit to them. And we had a government partner, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, with their objective auditors that would come out to the farm. And probably the most unique thing was the ability to do a risk assessment. So different mitigating strategies could be acceptable depending on the level of risk and what was to be mitigated. And so it wasn't a one-size-fits-all necessarily, and that different approaches could be acceptable as long as the goal was to produce safe food. And I can't emphasize enough what a watershed moment that was, not just on the Central Coast, but really for all lettuce and leafy green producers. And so I'm going to turn it over to Scott Horsfall, and he's going to talk about the LGME program.
Thank you, Joe. As usual, Joe's kind of presented a lot of what I was going to talk about, so I can move fairly quickly through these slides, which will save you some time, which may be a good thing. The Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, as Joe said, has been around since 2007, since the spinach outbreak, the E. coli 015787 outbreak of 2006. And at the heart of our program is what we call the metrics or the standards or the good ag practices. And those are a code of practices that are very specific and that are very specific to the leafy greens industry in California. So most of our production is here on the Central Coast, but we also cover leafy green production in the Central Valley and during the winter months, in particular, in Imperial Valley as well. And the idea was to have a code of practices that really identified all of the risks that were known, and to have very specific standards to address those. I would point out, again, it's only leafy greens, so there are a lot of products that are grown in this area that we do not regulate in any way, that we don't have anything really to do with. But if you grow salads or spinach or lettuce or cabbage, any of those types of products, they do fall under the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement. The metrics cover these areas, and I'll kind of quickly go through some of the specifics related to each of those areas. But again, what Joe said is exactly right. When the standards were written, there were already guidance documents that existed, but they were fairly general. What the group did when they created the LGMA was to try to hang very specific science-based standards on each of those, on that framework. So that he mentioned water. So the original language was use water that's suitable for its intended purpose. The writers of the LGMA metric said, okay, what does that mean for us? What's the microbial standard? How often do you test for it? And importantly, what do you do if you have a spike in those numbers? How do you make a change? And everything was designed to minimize the risk of contamination of crops that were going to go to consumers. So I just mentioned the water. So there's a monthly testing requirement. So all of our growers test all of the water that they use at least once a month. And there are microbial standards. It's an EPA standard that's used to determine whether or not that water meets the requirement or not. But we also have standards for water that's used post-harvest. So if you're going to rinse product in the field or something, there's a standard for that as well. Soil amendments were recognized as a very important category. We have banned, for want of a better word, the use of any non- or untreated soil amendments. And then we have criteria for all other soil amendments. So if you're going to use compost, you have to have verification that's been treated properly. And in most cases, you then also have to have test results that show that it's free of pathogens. The environment, as Joe also mentioned, is a really important factor. So we require actually three levels of environmental assessment. So growers will assess the land before they ever plant it. They'll do it again within 7 days of harvest, and then they'll do a daily harvest assessment. There's a host of requirements for workers having to do with health and hygiene. Hand washing is very important. In fact, we developed an app that growers can use to train their workers in proper procedures for washing hands and how often you have to do it. We make sure that training is in place so that everybody who's got fingerprints on the product, for want of a better word, that they are all trained in food safety as well as in their job responsibilities and their visitor policies as well. And then there are specific requirements for sanitation and cleaning of field equipment, particularly any food contact surfaces that are used in harvesting product. It's very important that we use government auditors. I should have stated earlier, but the LGMA is part of the state government. So we operate under the California Department of Food and Agriculture. We are run by an advisory board made up of the industry, but that board is advisory to the Secretary of Agriculture. So it's really important to understand that we are, we say quasi-governmental, but we do operate under the auspices of the Department of Food and Ag. And so not only does that mean we have to follow their rules, but it means that we have the force of law behind us. So the growers and handler members have to follow the rules that we set down. We also integrate with the government at the auditor level. So we have a team of inspectors. They are ag inspectors who work for the Department of Food and Ag and who are licensed and trained by USDA as well. And those are the individuals who go out on the farm and who do our audits. And those auditors are all trained in HACCP. They're trained in ISO standards. They're evaluated regularly by USDA. You see other requirements that are there as well. So we have about 4 to 5 individuals who essentially do nothing but leafy greens audits on a year-round basis. A big development for the industry came over the last couple of years with the advent of the Food Safety Modernization Act. This is an act that was actually signed in 2010, I think it was, by President Obama, but it is importantly the first time the federal government has had food safety authority and oversight on farms. And so we recognized from the very beginning that this was an opportunity for the LGMA program to work hand-in-hand with the federal government. So we set out to make sure that everything that was in that produce safety rule, which is part of the FSMA Act, is also incorporated into the LGMA metrics. So we went through a multi-step process. We worked closely with FDA. We identified where there might have been gaps in between what we were already doing and what was required by the federal government. And we put those, we had those accepted by our board last year. And those audits started April 1st. So even though the federal government won't be doing on-farm inspections or verification until next spring, we've already incorporated that into the LGMA program, and we're working with the Department of Food and Ag on that compliance as well. In our metrics, we do continue to focus as much as we can on sound science. There's been an awful lot of research that's been done in the last 10 years since the program started. There's a group called the Center for Produce Safety that has been looking at all aspects of production. So we update the standards fairly regularly with new information that comes in. And I just quickly, because I know it should be talked about, we are once again coming off of a fairly major issue when it comes to food safety. There was a large E. coli outbreak last spring that was traced to the Yuma, Arizona area, but even though that's another state and we don't operate there, Arizona does have a sister agency. They have the Arizona Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, and we work in tandem with them, try to remain in lockstep with them. So both organizations will be doing some more updates to our standards. They were just completed last week, as a matter of fact, in order to respond to and adjust to the conditions that were identified from this latest outbreak. So the good thing, if there is a good thing, it's a tragic outbreak, obviously, but the good thing is the programs already exist this time. So we didn't have to kind of come together and will it into existence, but we could respond fairly quickly. And I think the industry has stepped up and done that as quickly as they could. So there will be some additional changes that we'll be talking about over the next several weeks coming forward. I think that completes my presentation. Dan?
So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the how food safety and co-management decisions happen. As you can probably be aware that, I mean, again, as Joe said, food safety is a number one priority because it is the health and safety of the consumer. It's the people that eat the product from our farms that, you know, need to have the confidence in our products. And a lot of times, even though that's, you know, job one, there's a lot of things that we have to juggle on the farming operation or within our operation that at times make that very difficult to maneuver. And so I'm going to go through maybe just an example of that and then a little bit more about some of the decision-making that we do with food safety on the farm. So as you can see on this slide, on the top there is the requirement from the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement, or what we call our metrics within that agreement. And below that is the requirement for, you know, out of the Irrigated Lands 3.0. So what I want to describe with those two principles right next to each other is we as the LGMA have our metrics, which I'll add to the previous speakers that when we joined the LGMA, it was voluntary. So all of the membership of the LGMA joined it voluntarily. But once you join, it is now mandatory. So we are held very strictly to the standards of the metrics. In our metrics, when it calls for a buffer, it's a buffer. It's a certain amount of feet that has to be accomplished. It doesn't stipulate whether it has to be bare soil or whether it's vegetative. But there are buffers that exist for certain conditions on the farm. One of the things about a vegetative buffer that creates a decision that we have to make on the farm is that a lot of times a vegetative buffer can create a habitat for animals. And that was mentioned a little bit earlier, rodents being one of them. And when I say animals, years ago under the LGMA, we were really focused on what we called five animals of significant risk. The metrics can be updated with science, as Scott had mentioned. We updated those metrics years ago to include all animals, and that includes birds, squirrels, frogs, dogs, cows, I mean, any animal, because they all possess a risk to the crop in the field. So with these vegetative buffers, it can create a habitat for these animals that we're very concerned about. And what actually ends up happening is you have the vegetative buffer, but because of our metrics, we're now having to extend that buffer even further. So we have to buffer from the buffer because we've created an animal habitat. I can share with you about 6 years ago on one of our farms, we had a crop that an outside company was looking to come in and buy. They were going to buy the whole thing. And we had a vegetative strip on the west side of this crop. They would not buy that field of this product unless that vegetative strip was taken completely down to bare soil. Now, at that point, we have a decision to make. Do we take it down to bare soil to sell the crop? Or do we leave it in and not sell this entire field to this particular customer? Years ago, I made the decision that we weren't going to take it down. This was a customer that we didn't regularly do business with. It was kind of a special moment, a special buy, and we weren't going to take the vegetative strip down at that moment. But in a different hindsight, if I was contracted with that customer, and it was my obligation to provide that product to that customer, and that was part of the contract that I had, that vegetative strip may have had to have been taken down. We have the LGMA metrics, but there's also what we call the buyer standard as well. And when I say buyer, I'm talking about a lot of the retail chains we all visit. Kroger's, Vons, Smart and Final, Walmart, Food for Less. So we have the metrics which we follow, but they a lot of times put additional requirements on top of us in order for us to sell our products to them. One of the other folks that take a lot of our products we grow are in the processing industry. Those people that take our whole product, take it to their processing plant, and they put it in those lovely bags that we all get to enjoy after a long day, where you go home and take it out of the fridge and put it into a bowl and it's ready to go. They also place additional requirements. So when we say we have a buffer on a buffer, we may buffer 30 feet from a riparian area, but they could put additional requirements to where that could be 50 feet or 100 feet, or whether they won't even take the field, or if there's a vegetative strip there, they won't take it either. So these are, you know, some of the considerations that we have to make when we're looking at co-management. This next slide also just kind of talks about, again, what we had just discussed, so I'll move through it. So the LGMA is unique, I think, in its existence. It is a public-private partnership. It is our Leafy Greens community that came together and said, we want to fix food safety. We want to prevent foodborne illness from happening. But we also wanted to make sure that we had a partner in this, and that was the California Department of Food and Ag. And one of the things about the Leafy Greens is that we have, you know, standards or metrics that we have to follow. And what that allows us to do is that we have to meet the standard, but it doesn't script to us how we get there. So it leaves each operation a little bit of flexibility on how we can achieve the ultimate goal that's dictated out in the metrics. What's on the screen right now is a flow chart for animal intrusion. The metrics, you know, give us very clear standards that we have to follow when it comes to animal intrusion. And this flow chart actually kind of goes through that decision-making process. And this is used throughout our Leafy Greens community as a tool for those on the farm. It allows them to make better decisions when they come across different things. But one of the biggest things in this flow chart is that we have to assess the animal activity as a low, medium, or high risk. And each of those can have different levels of mitigation. So an example of a low risk might be that we see footprints on the road outside the field. We didn't see them in. We have to note it. We have to, you know, be aware that they're there. But it's a low risk, so we didn't see any entry. A medium risk might be the type of thing where an animal goes into the field, you see footprints, but you do see some defecation in the field. At that point, if we only see the one spot, we can buffer that spot, destroy the produce in within that buffer. Okay, and again, we're being cognizant and documenting that this did occur there, but we've mitigated that medium risk because it was only once occurring. A high risk may be is that there's just a lot of issues. There might be animal feeding, a lot of defecation in the field, a lot of tracks. And at that point, we have to make the bigger decision as to whether we're going to go into that field or not. And not most of the time when it's that bad. But it's this type of flow chart that runs us through that decision-making process, again, of getting to the ultimate goal of protecting our consumers. Listed on this slide are just some resources. You know, when we look at co-management issues. And then I'm going to hand it back over to Joe, who's going to talk about some research.
Thanks. Thank you. So there was talk about research earlier. In fact, even questions about, you know, what does the board challenged on the research part of it. But in the food safety arena, prior to 2006, there really was no research on food safety. In fact, when we looked at creating standards, metrics, if you will, for the LGMA, there was no research on irrigation water. And so we had to borrow from another industry or another regulation. We looked at recreational water and used that as a standard, figuring, well, if you could swim in it, that should be okay to irrigate your crops with. And that was the starting point because there was absolutely no research. But since then, there's been a much improvement in that area. The California Leafy Greens Research Board, which normally would do mostly plant disease research, has allocated $1.1 million of food safety research over the years. And Scott mentioned the Center for Produce Safety. They've raised and allocated $23.4 million towards food safety research, 138 projects. And they engage academic institutions across the country and internationally as well. And so here are a few of the studies that they've worked on, and they're very appropriate for the hazards that we've talked about. A vertebrate study to keep tree frogs out of fields, so nobody wants to have a little frog in their bag of spinach. And so there's research underway to look at engineering and ecological methods to prevent that from happening. Corey Knives, as a vector for transferring contamination, so there was a study that they looked at the actual instruments used to harvest produce. Well, it turns out that if those instruments had a welded piece on there, that was a harborage for contamination. And so if you had an instrument that was completely smooth, much easier to clean and sanitize. And, I mean, that's something that we've all incorporated. There was talk earlier about tailwater reuse. And that certainly is, in 2014, prioritizing the water basins. Well, surface water runoff is to be captured. But what do you do with that water? And so there's studies underway right now, both through Center for Produce Safety and the Leafy Greens Research Board, on the quality of that water and what can you do with it. Can you reuse it as irrigation water or not? And then Scott talked a little bit about buffer zones and certainly is pertinent to the Yuma area foodborne illness outbreak that happened this past winter and spring. Really looking at distances of producing lettuce and leafy greens to these concentrated animal feed operations and what those distances should be. So that's the kind of research that's gone in. It did not exist till all this happened, until there was a real need. There's no question about it. Surface water health, safe and affordable drinking water, you know, along with food safety, I mean, that's all got to go hand in hand. And we do urge the board to create regulations that allow a process that incentivizes growers to try practices that haven't been perhaps proven. And an example of that would be my colleague, Dale Huss, who has testified before and also toured a nitrate harvester that he had worked on with a scientist up in the Bay Area. Even though that didn't really prove to be commercially viable and being able to scale up, it did lead to other improvements to bioreactors and even to further science with better mediums for that kind of process to improve, you know, surface water quality. And so really a focus and create a space for innovation for best management practices is really what we're advocating. You know, really our goal today was to help understand the complexity of food safety requirements and how they relate to the topics that you're faced with, that we're all faced with. And we encourage the efforts to complement them, not contradict in the long run. And just a little bit about general farm management. Dan talked a little bit about the harvesting process. And both our operations are vertically integrated. So we farm, we have our own harvesting crews, we sell and cool and ship the product. But most growers, most farmers are contracted with different operations. And so they don't control that process necessarily. They're going to bring a crop up to harvest, and then the company that they've contracted with, the shipper or the processor, is going to make the decision on when and where to harvest and what to do with that product. Dan talked about the decision whether to sell a field or not to a particular customer, and those are decisions that we're faced with every day. And he didn't call them these, but what we're faced with a lot of customers, retailers, processors, are what they call supermetrics. So if a little is good, a lot must be better. Well, there's not always science behind that. And that really becomes a rub, and it really puts growers in a tough spot. I'll leave you with this thought. I grew up on a small farm here on the Central Coast. My dad grew artichokes. Same thing my grandfather did, permanent crop. So we lived, the agricultural life, right? So some years things were lean. You had floods, you had freezes, drought, all things that we still experience today, probably even more so. But what really hampered his operation was seawater intrusion. His well was a mile from the coast. And those are things that I take with me, that our whole community takes with us. So now I run a much bigger operation than what my dad used to run. I used to kid my dad. I'd tell him, "Hey, Dad, you were a small family farmer, and that's in vogue today, right?" But for him, it was just a heck of a lot of work, and it was a tough way to make a living. But we're in the CSIP project, the Castrol Seawater Intrusion Project. I mean, why do we support that? Because that's the right thing to do, not just for farming out on the coast, but for the whole community, because it's the drinking water that all the communities where we live use. And if we can't control that, then what are these places are going to do? What are these towns are going to do? We've also restored hundreds of acres of wetlands. We have the ability to do that. And we've partnered with the Elkhorn Slough Foundation, with the Central Coast Wetlands Group to do this, again, because this was another measure for improving water quality, preventing seawater intrusion. But it's not just treating water off our farms. It's treating water off of the whole Moro Coho watershed. And again, why would we do that? Well, it's because we're part of this community, too. And so we're up here talking about food safety. Well, it's the same food that we take home to our families. It's the same food that our employees take home. It's the same food that you eat. And we're in a great place, right? This is fresh produce. This is the stuff you're supposed to be eating. And I hope we're all eating plenty of it. So we're passionate about what we do. The food safety certainly was something that we needed to respond to. And there's still a lot of work to do. There's no doubt about it. And working with the regional board on surface water quality, I mean, that's something that we're all engaged in. But it's something that has to be done in a way that is practical. And that's what we learned in food safety, that the standards have to be practical to be implemented. And we demand, Scott's program demands 100% compliance. If you're in this program, you have to do these things. And so this is just a bit of the context that we all sit in. And I appreciate your listening to me.
Thank you. So I'm going to start on my left. I see any question or comments from my colleagues?
Yeah, primarily for Dan and Joe. I think this is the best opportunity I have for a frank discussion with you. It kills me to think of what the Salinas Valley, Moro Coho, used to be like, before people like us came here, very, very vibrant, healthy habitats for all kinds of life. And now when I drive around, I see different waterways, different dirt ditches that look like I wouldn't want to put my finger in them. And we're trying as a board here to sustain policies to maintain fractional green strips along some of these waterways. And it's running smack into the conflict of food safety and huge marketing potential losses for all of you that have to manage both the greenways and the fields that need to be harvested. So, you know, can you give us any sliver of advice of how we're going to do both? Because you're basically telling us you can't have green strips almost. And to me, it's like it's such a token legacy to what used to be there. And we're seeing on field trips and hearing from you here that those are major problematic areas for you to maintain.
So advice or something that the silver bullet maybe you're looking for today, I wouldn't be able to give you today. You know, there are benefits to the green strips, as we talk about, but the complexity of those have changed, especially for the fresh produce industry in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, wasn't really considered, wasn't thought of. But now it's a very big focal point for a lot of the buyers that we sell our things to. One thing I would like to see is that maybe the solution to that isn't available today, but much like we did when Joe and great industry leaders came together when they formed the LGMA, is that they worked together with a common goal. And not only amongst our community, but they also worked with our regulatory agencies because they had a common goal. And I do think that there could be a solution reached if we can take that step of working together to find that common goal. It's just we have to make sure that, as Joe had mentioned, that it's practical because there's a lot of decision influences that go into making that final decision. And I think as long as those are all considered, I think there is a solution that could be reached. But it's going to take a lot of input and a lot of understanding of what those issues are.
All right. Well, thanks to the three of you for your efforts. Joe, are you going to add in something?
I was just going to say that, I think it also is looking at other potential solutions as well. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about bioreactors. You know, that's treating surface water. I'm not saying that's the answer necessarily, but it's probably more than one solution to accomplish your goal. And that's what we're here to say is let's be open-minded enough to look at different solutions.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for being here. If I go back to your Marler-Clark diagram or chart, is it correct to say that in prior to 95, and we don't have, at least in this chart, we don't have any instances of these mass food-borne illness outbreaks because of vegetables, does this coincide with then the bagging of green leafy vegetables? Is it coincidental? Is it related to that? Because growing up, I don't recall this happening.
I think one difference is that the science is a lot better. The network, the PulseNet system is much better for reporting illnesses, and they have a faster way of connecting, fingerprinting these kinds of outbreaks. Now, I'm not an expert on epidemiology or that, but I did participate in an exercise with the CDC once, and it was to look at how quickly can they trace these types of potentially multi-state incidences. And so I think the science is a lot better. I think that traceback is a lot better. I think that identifying product is much better now. A lot more product is identified and packaged. Is it the packaging that's causing it? I don't know that you can say that.
And when did packaging start? I don't have a memory as to when that came into being.
Probably in the early 90s as well.
Okay.
But I wouldn't draw that conclusion without really some investigation.
Yeah, I'm just looking for similarities.
And one thing I'd comment about the bag is, you know, our food supply in this country is amazing, and the safety of that food supply is absolutely incredible. And the technology that rather than the baggers, the processors use to conduct that process, the safeties that they have in place to make sure that that product goes out in a safe condition is quite remarkable. And just to reiterate what Joe was saying, science has jumped leaps and bounds. And I think as that continues to improve, which it's going to, detection levels are going to improve, we're going to need to continually adjust our practices because we're growing out in the environment. We're growing out, you know, in the beautiful Central Coast. And as these things developed, we're also going to need to adapt to those changes and develop as well.
Further question, with the list of instances in this chart, were the bacterial, well, it's the same bacterial strain, O157H7, so were those traced back to actual farms?
So their ability to trace out, their ability to identify outbreaks is much more advanced than their ability to trace them back. And we've been going through this for 4 or 5 months now in terms of what went on in Yuma, Arizona this year. But I'll use another example. So the CDC has recently shared some data on outbreaks just for the last decade or so. So what you see on the screen, that's just, I think, a partial list. So that's not in any way conclusive. I think they just grabbed a piece of that to show you kind of what we're talking about. But they did share some data on something like 29 outbreaks that they believe are associated with leafy greens, mostly pretty small, you know, under 8 to 10 people ill. Of those, there are, if I remember right, 7 that they were able to trace back pretty convincingly to a farm or farms, either in California or in Arizona, and those are pretty rare. So it's and even with as large an outbreak as they're dealing with from last spring, the traceback is kind of all over the board, which also gets to your other question. It's clearly not a case of convergence from a single packing line or packing house, but rather there are something like 30 different ranches on different farms that they have had traceback pointing towards. It's kind of a convoluted answer to your question, but
it does.
And don't assume that it's all from the farm either. I mean,
I'm not. I question whether it might be from handling, you know, within the plant or something. And I'm just looking as
all along the whole supply chain.
Yeah. So maybe this is for you, Joe, or the others. Where is the slide that has, okay, the ag order on it? Now, the one with our ag order 3.0 language requiring the buffer strip. So this kind of goes to, there it is on the bottom. So this kind of goes to my comment I made earlier about micromanaging you guys. Why don't we, if we just take that out, then, you know, we kind of do away with this whole problem that you've got with food safety. We don't micromanage that. We let you guys figure it out. And we just say, here's what you got to meet, the standard off the farm or in the receiving water. And you guys can focus your time on trying to solve that, which I see as the problem, more than trying to tell you where you should and shouldn't have a strip. Any comments?
You know, I appreciate that comment. You know, I as Joe said, our operations are somewhat similar in that we're vertically integrated. So Joe has a sales staff, and I have a sales staff. And if I ask my sales staff to call Joe's sales staff to become buddy-buddy and help each other out, on that level, they may not do it. But on a food safety level, it's a completely different atmosphere. Joe's phone is always available to me and my staff. My phone is always available to him. And it goes for every other company because we realize that we are in this together. You know, if it's a spinach outbreak or romaine outbreak, it doesn't matter whose it was. If you have that commodity, we're all affected. And that's why we're all in this together. Something like this is something that we're all in together. Because this is something that we could work on collectively. This is something that we would have that open door, open phone policy with, because this really is in our best interest to find a solution to that works for us on multiple fronts.
So I'm not sure if that answered my question, really. But
let me maybe another.
Go, you try.
Let me try. Okay. From the food safety world, and it was on one of the slides about each company has its own standard operating procedures, their own SOPs on worker hygiene, for example. And, you know, does that mean, well, every worker, harvester wears gloves and hairnet and sleeves? Well, not necessarily. That's somewhat up to the company to decide exactly what the techniques are. But what they have to demonstrate is that they are doing what they say they're doing, and that it does prove food safety. But they have the flexibility to implement it in a way that makes most sense for their operation, because every operation is different, every farm's different. And so from that example, it allows the company to implement what they think is best, but they have to prove that, right? They have to prove it to the auditors that what they're doing is effective.
So really my question goes to this, and I'm trying to step us back from this. This is just an example of us micromanaging you. And I'm saying, okay, let's take this out. Maybe we should take out all of the micromanaging that's in our permit. All of it. And just say, look, here's the water quality standard. And just, you guys know best. Your farms are all different. Up and down the criteria. Just meet the standards for receiving waters, for groundwater.
And provide resources to help, perhaps, in education and understanding. But yes,
I mean, does that make more sense? That's kind of where I'm going. Does that kind of make more sense than us forcing something like this on you, which is obviously creating a lot of consternation and consequence?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you,
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. That was very interesting, what Mr. Young just suggested, because I'm interested in talking about buffers also, but maybe coming at it from a different angle, because we have had some experience due to the order with experimenting in the use of buffers, not for habitat, but to actually reduce tailwater runoff, sediment control, and so forth. So from that angle, I have a two-part question, so I'll ask the first part and then see if I need the second part. But would you say that more or less the use of buffers has helped you to see reduced tailwater runoff from farm operations? Has it been effective as a one of your options or one of your tools, one of your solutions that's helped to decrease the amount of tailwater entering surface waters?
I think it's a tool in the tool chest along with other techniques.
Right, right. So my second question is then, the earlier we heard that there, I think UC Extension, is doing research and on the ground pilot projects with use of different types of vegetation that are less friendly to rodents or whatever animal life. Are those options, do those seem attractive to you to continue to have that tool in the toolbox that would not be necessarily in conflict with the food safety requirements?
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about, right? Advancing science, advancing research,
right,
to provide better tools.
Right, right.
And, you know, if there's something that isn't an attractant to you know, to rodents or animal life, I think that's an improvement.
Yeah. And the other question I have is, I think we've all become accustomed to seeing those little white pipes in the fields that are intended to trap small animals. Do you think there's any risk of, I don't know how they work, and maybe that would be the question. How do those function to reduce the animal presence or animal contact with the crop? And have you seen any evidence, or is there any suggestion that whatever materials are in those traps are also being tracked onto the field? Is that a possibility?
So the white pipes you're referring to, I can picture it in my head, just I'm sure as you can. The use of those are really just for rodents. Okay. So and really for nothing more than rodents. The bait that's applied in those is regulated by the Ag Commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's absolutely a consideration that the bait that's placed in there, that we are very worried about not getting any of that into the field. That's why there are buffers that exist between edge of crop to where those are placed. So when it comes to managing animal intrusion on a larger scale, and we're now talking wildlife, and again, you know, it could be pigs, it could be a deer, it could be coyotes. It could be the neighbor that likes to walk their dog after the workers go home for the day. You know, there's a lot of tools that we can deploy that try to prevent it, deter it. But again, there's not that one thing that's 100%. But that's why you deploy the tools you have in your tool chest to get you so far. But that's where it comes down to our environmental assessments, training of our employees, observing, you know, 7 days before you go to harvest, has anything changed? And now you're doing that investigation every day you harvest that field. And so it really boils down to education, and not just education of the principals of the company, but it's education from the principals of the company all the way down to the people that are packing that product for us. And so it's a multi-step function when it comes to deterring wildlife and bigger animals.
Well, you anticipated my final question to you. How robust is education at the various levels beyond training? Because training implies, okay, this is a practice we are going to adopt, and this is how it's done. So that's application of an actual practice. But above training, there is kind of a sense of what Joe was referring to in terms of the broader toolkit, the broader option of solutions that are available. So, and that's coming out of folks like the UC Extension, UC Davis, and some of our other technical consultants that are available in the region. So do you feel that through your organizations, your farm organizations, that information is being moved quickly, it's being moved effectively, and accessibility for farmers at different levels, maybe the smallest farmers have a harder time, you know, reaching or accessing that kind of information? When does it happen? You know, do you think that is another aspect of moving the goalpost?
Yeah, and I'm going to speak a little bit to it, but I'm going to let Joe and I both kind of, I think we both have a, we can talk on this for a while, I think. But when it comes to food safety, and it'll relate to your question, so just bear with me here a minute. You know, we refer a lot to the culture of food safety. And a lot of that is the education. It's the use of material that's developed. It's the use of science. But it's getting that information and making sure that, at least through my operation, that that useful information that can be applied is passed down to the relevant users. One thing that the LGMA has established is a huge information and training center for its members. So, you know, when there's an update, a scientifically based update to our metrics, they push that information out to everyone that's willing to get it. And then we take that and then we pass that down through, you know, our operation and our people. So, an example of the LGMA, the information that's new, learned, it gets passed down very quickly and is passed down to us in a very useful manner. So,
so I know real quickly, because time is short, it's also making people understand the why. Why are we doing this?
Right.
And that really makes a big difference.
Right. And there's multiple answers to that. Yeah. Multiple benefits, I should say. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ms. Grape?
I don't have any questions. I've heard a couple times that, you know, answering the question why and ensuring that that's answered helps the dialogue and implementation so that people know what they're doing. I mean, that's really basic. So appreciate that. Thanks for the presentation.
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah. Thank you for your presentation. I mean, the impact of food safety on consumers is obvious. I get the impact on farmers. Frankly, in 2006, I was working for the Teamsters Union, and we had close to 1,000 workers at River Ranch, Taylor Farms, and Newstar who lost their jobs for months because spinach production was shut down, and their job was bagged spinach. And I understand the conflicts that you're talking about in terms of vegetated buffer zones and food safety requirements that are either self-imposed or outside-imposed. I guess I'd like to hear some examples of, you know, alternative methods. I mean, and also, incidentally, I agree with you that riparian zones and vegetated buffer zones they're not the same thing, you know. Selecting a vegetated buffer media because no animals like to live in it, clearly that's something different than a riparian zone, which has part of its raison d'etre is an animal corridor. But clearly our motivation for the language you cite from 3.0 is to minimize erosion, both because of the sedimentation consequences and because of the fact that some of the pesticides that are being used tend to stick to sediment. When you move the sediment, you move the pesticide. So when you have situations where you have bare soil, because that's what's being required of you by food safety, and where what you're being required to do now is do the bare soil buffer plus the vegetated buffer, what are some examples of alternative measures? What are you're telling us to not be inflexible. That's fine. What are some examples of both of measures you could use and of what you think we should be asking you for?
I mean, one kind of quick example would be, well, you know, if you have runoff, obviously, and no grower wants to see the soil runoff, but is there your ability to, you know, change the direction of the rows so it's not so prone to that, you know, in a storm event? I mean, are there practical solutions that you can do by even, like, a lot of strawberry growers will put cover crop in between the rows, you know, especially during the winter months, So there are other techniques, other things, and I don't have a list of them for you, but it's certainly that we could compile. But I think that's the whole point. Let's look at all the potential possibilities, and maybe it's not just one silver bullet.
You know, to the fullest extent we can too. I mean, the ranches that we farm, there's not one ranch the same. Ranch A is not Ranch B. Ranch A and Ranch B are completely different, not only in its soil profiles and its location and its temperature, microclimate, but, you know, to the most we can, we try to position our crops for the most success. I mean, you know, so where we need that vegetative buffer with irrigated for 3.0, we can manage that to a certain extent, but at some point we run out of options, and it's those times where we run into that conflict. And it's really just because either of our crop rotations or the available ground we have to plant that we have that situation facing us. So those other options, I mean, there's discussion of grasses that don't attract things. I think that would be interesting to look at. Because it does take those steps towards reaching that co-management goal that accomplishes both things.
You know, we struggle with the exact same question. So you heard Joe talk about standards that are very specific. I talked about that too. And you heard Tan talk about we offer people some leeway, and companies have their own SOPs. And so we're always trying to find that sweet spot too between what do you prescribe as a very specific standard, like we do with our water testing, for instance, where there's not a lot of wiggle room, and where do you leave that agency or that ability to do a risk assessment and then base your company's policies on that? And that's the kind of thing Dan was just talking about, where you've got different fields that may have different conditions. And so, you know, you hear this one-size-fits-all gets used as a cliche all the time as something that doesn't work, but it's really true. So, I mean, I sympathize with the question because that's also a question that we deal with all the time. And I'm not sure there are any easy, clear-cut answers. I always wish there was research that just told us exactly what the buffer zone should be to be perfectly safe. And it just doesn't exist. So we make the best decisions we can with the information at hand.
All right, so being chair, I usually hold off to be the last one, so I always feel being the one causing overtime after the beep. But so I'll have a couple of very quick questions, and certainly also want to thank all of you for giving us, you know, some of your perspectives on some of the challenges that you have in being regulated from different parties and the conflict of some of those regulations. So I have a specific question and a more general one. So the specific one is with the Food Modernization Act, you know, being the latest standard, impact in the organic side of growing leafy greens. Is there any aspects that are a little bit different in regard to some of the challenges you have been discussing, or did you purposely lump traditional farming with organic, all having the same type of challenges?
When it comes to food safety, we don't identify any differences. So everything we said applies to everything that our members grow. And most of them these days do grow organic. We have some companies that are strictly organic. The Food Safety Modernization Act is not going to have a huge impact on leafy greens growers, conventional or organic, in this area, at least the commercial industry, the folks who are regulated by a program like ours. Across the country, the organic industry has raised a number of concerns having to do with, as I said, use of organic raw materials, or not organic, but raw manure, things like that, which we don't allow here. So even organic producers who are producing in this area are following the same rules that we've already established, are testing their compost. So we don't think it's going to have a huge impact really on any of our growers, because most of the LGMA standards go quite a bit above and beyond what's in the what we call the produce rule, that part of the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Okay. So then last question. You know, California and is not the only place, you know, that grows leafy greens. And some of you, some of the companies you work with or perhaps have worked with are international and have operations in many other countries. And when we look at, you know, food, you have domestic production, domestic consumption, export, import. So has your group looked at best management practice and then the challenges? I'll use the EU as an example because, you know, Europe eat lettuce just like we do. And would you say that our standards in that you have are the most stringent? Was there any takeaway that you were able to import, so to speak, in terms of ideas?
Well, I would, I'll let Joe answer this because they probably produce in some of those areas, but I would
That's
say
why
that
I was making that, eye contact.
Yeah. Okay. Well, go ahead. I'll let you
You finish your slide. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the LGMA standard is pretty widely perceived to be probably the most stringent. There is an Arizona LGMA, so 90% of the leafy greens grown in the United States are covered by one program or the other. And most of the big companies who are producing in Mexico or in Florida or in Texas, they are using at least the LGMA standard, if not some of these buyer standards, for all of their leafy green production, no matter where it is. Now, I'm not quite sure how it relates to selling to some of those countries.
Well, and I'm not sure if I got that part of it, but I would say that the produce rule or the Food Safety Modernization Act also has the import rule, and that too is supposed to harmonize or put the onus on any importer that's bringing product from another country that it meets the same food safety practices that are employed here domestically. If your question was, did we look to Europe for food safety standards, I don't know. I can't think of a specific example of that, but we certainly are conscious of what practices are in other areas. And they may be different because of different, geography situations. They could be different.
Yeah, because, you know, when you had your first slide with the statistics, it can be interpreted in many ways. Where if we compare the statistics with other imports or in other countries, this may be actually, and I'm not trying to diminish the consequences, but, you know, maybe a very small percentage of incidents or accidents that have occurred compared to others. You know, it's there's many other industries where you use statistics saying a number of accidents per 1,000 miles, but it's also based on the number of vehicles on the road. You know, so I was looking at these statistics, and I'm like, well, I can't quite put it in the context.
I don't know the numbers. Leafy greens have a very short shelf life. So unlike, I used to work with the grape growers in the Central Valley, and we exported, 40% of the crop. Other than Canada, which is kind of an extension of the domestic market, very little of the leafy greens crop is exported, and except for product coming in from Mexico, there's very little in the way of imports as well.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you again on behalf of myself and my colleagues for bearing with us and helping us get a good overview of the food safety and the management. So at this time, I'm going to give Mr. Robertson two choices. One choice is a break. The second choice is public comments, and then a break after that. What's your pleasure?
Again, let's go with number two.
I guess.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.